You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Alan Young. The U.S. Department of Justice recently charged an Elk Grove woman with leading a transnational white supremacist terrorist organization. It's called the Terrorgram Collective. At least three hate-driven crimes, including a shooting at an LGBTQ bar in Slovakia, a stabbing near a mosque in Turkey, and a plot to attack an energy grid in New Jersey, were allegedly tied to guidance shared by Dallas Humber and a co-conspirator. Joining us today is Dr. Spencer Sunshine, a researcher and author of books about the radical right, to discuss what these charges mean and the rise of extremist movements. Spencer, welcome to Insight.
Thanks for having me on the show.
I want to start by giving our readers a little bit of background on what happened in Elk Grove. Dallas Humber of Elk Grove, along with co-conspirator Matthew Allison of Boise, Idaho, were charged this month with 15 federal counts, including soliciting hate crimes, conspiring to murder federal officials, and providing material support to terrorists. As leaders of the Terrorgram Collective, their aim was to ignite a race war. Okay, Spencer, let's start with the Terrorgram Collective. Who are they and how did they start?
Well, this is a interesting question that I think we will find more about as the court case goes on. So what's going on now is essentially that there has developed over the last decade or so an international network of real and aspiring neo-Nazi terrorists. And they have kind of morphed from having actual groups into having a sort of larger milieu around them, and now into a shifting series of Telegram channels that are dubbed Terrorgram. And so the idea of the Terrorgram Collective is that there actually is a designated small number of people who are running a lot of these channels and producing publications. Publications are being produced under that name. And so they are helping be the inspiration, both intellectual but also practical inspiration, to encourage people to engage in attacks against marginalized people around the world. It's moving to be around the world now.
So our last segment was actually about the problems that arise when a social media platform makes errors in its censorship. But concerns raised with Telegram deal with the fact that the app has little to no content moderation. The New York Times found that 1,500 channels operated by white supremacists who coordinate activities among almost 1 million people around the world. I want to talk about the impact of Telegram on these groups.
Well, I was going to say it is Telegram because the other platforms have cracked down. So and because Telegram generally doesn't. And I think they eventually started a number of years ago, first with ISIS, and now they do with the most radical white supremacist channels. But they just pop back up. You know, you suppressed one and they pop back up and they're ready to do this now. So it in some sense, like, it's Telegram, but it could be something else.
So we haven't seen a large shifting or a revitalizing of white supremacist organizations through Telegram.
It's a good place for them to work. I think that the organized white supremacist movement, so, you know, here, to people to the right of Trump, people for whom Stop the Steal was like, and 1-6 was generally like too moderate a thing, have been pretty, I think they built a large movement starting with the first Trump campaign in the United States, let's say, because it is transnational. And they've kind of continued at a good clip. You know, that movement isn't, I don't think that Telegram has made it expand the whole movement, but it's certainly, that movement isn't shrinking, and it has given a lot of breathing space for the terrorist wing. That is definitely true, for the terrorist wing to open, work openly and to organize transnationally.
Tell our listeners about accelerationism. This is a term that I was unfamiliar with until I started reading about Dallas Humber.
Sure. It's, well, on one hand, it's this old idea that all kinds of radical political movements have, that is basically things have to get worse before they're going to get better, right? But this version is an extreme version of that, and it's that not just do things have to get worse, but the whole system has to be collapsed before, you know, in their case, a national socialist state can be established, or whatever kind of Aryan imperium can arise. These are terms that they use. And so what this has meant is that they no longer, people advocating this idea no longer have to like build political movements. Like they've moved even beyond a notion of guerrilla warfare, like that you would have armed groups as the sort of wing of a bigger political movement. Now they just are attempting to encourage acts that will cause mass panic and chaos and hopefully like social conflagration. So this can mean that they can start just cheering on massacres, that they're encouraging individuals to do high profile, violent acts. In particular, they're very interested in what happened in Christchurch, New Zealand, where a guy killed 51 Muslims in at two mosques and live streamed it, right? It became this almost iconic act for them. And so accelerationism means they don't have to engage in any kind of regular political activity, but under the rubric that the whole they can somehow collapse, the system, the liberal state and society, they can encourage just dramatic acts of murder and mass murder.
Well, I want to get into the Elk Grove case, but first let's step back and talk a little bit about your work. You've spent decades researching the far right in America, and you recently published a book. Can you tell us a little bit about your area of study?
Sure, for I got involved in some of this work in 1990 when I was in the punk rock scene at the time of the Nazi skinhead sort of explosion in the US and sort of got to see what that looked like, how violent it was, and how people organized up front. I've been doing the work for really since I think around 2005, and we saw it was so interesting because throughout the aughts and into the teens, it was that movement still existed, but very few people paid attention to it. And when Trump started his initial campaign, it blew up, and suddenly people realized again that this movement was here, but it had always been here. And so, I've tracked different parts of it since then. I recently published a book called Neo-Nazi Terrorism and Countercultural Fascism: The Origins and Afterlife of James Mason's Siege. It's on a Routledge, and it's about the book. It's this book, Siege, that inspires this neo-Nazi terrorist milieu we have today, Terrorgram and these other different groups. It's the sort of intellectual lodestone behind it.
So you have a firm understanding of the history of some of these movements, and using that lens, what struck you about these arrests, including that of a Dallas Humber of Elk Grove?
Well, Humber was outed about a year and a half ago by anti-fascist activists. And it was interesting. It was clear that she was encouraging, hate crimes, attacks, violent attacks across not just the US, but internationally, and wasn't arrested. And so even at the time, I was like, because I told a reporter this, I was like, the feds are watching and they're biding their time to wait for the right political movement or where they have enough evidence or trying to figure out what charges to use. So, on one hand, it was interesting to see how long they waited, even from when we publicly knew who she was and where she was. The second is that they used a strategy. For years, they've pushed, the authorities have pushed to have new laws to prosecute white supremacist terrorists. And many of us have said there's no need for that. There's plenty of laws on the books to do these things. And indeed, they found an existing law and they charged her with this. It's a law about material support for terrorists outside the United States. The Terrorgram Collective is banned now in Britain, where they can ban groups. And she and the others have been in direct contact with people across the world, encouraging them to commit attacks. And like we saw, both in Slovakia, where two people were killed, and in Turkey, where five people were just knifed in this attack outside a mosque, that there are these international relationships. And so this is an interesting new legal strategy that the DOJ is dusting off to prosecute her and her co-conspirator. And we'll see what they if they use this in the future as well. It's a different tack to take.
So she's on their radar. She was named in a report, and then the report was written about by the HuffPost. So it's getting out there in mainstream media, and they know that she's linked, or at least allegedly linked, to actual hate crimes, like instances where people have gone out and killed people. Why do you think they wait?
It's a lot of prosecutions have to do with internal political and organizational structures inside of the FBI and inside the Department of Justice about what their priorities are for the moment, how much more information they want to collect, if they think they're in a position to, do they want to sort of expand the use of certain laws or not? So I just think there's a lot of internal stuff that we can't see from the outside that decides these things. I think everyday people are under some impression that, like, the authorities get wind that a crime has been committed, and then when they have some evidence, they go and arrest the person. It doesn't always work like that. I don't think it usually works like that for more higher profile federal felonies.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. If you're just joining us, we're talking with Spencer Sunshine, a researcher and author of books about the radical right, to talk about an Elk Grove woman charged with running a white supremacist online terrorist organization. So, Spencer, I'd like to talk about the accused, Dallas Humber of Elk Grove. How common is it for women to be involved in these types of organizations?
It is not common, but it is not unheard of. So it's certainly unusual, especially that women are involved in these organizations. It's a question of how key the role they have. It is very uncommon, but there have been cases in which women play a key role in these very extreme ends of the white supremacist movement. In the more moderate ends, like, there are quite a number of women. Sometimes they take more traditional roles, you know, gender roles. Sometimes they take more active roles. It's less common to see them in the more extreme terrorist ends, but they are sprinkled around there. So it's unusual, but I think at this point in the game, people who watch this are just like, it's not a shocking thing to people.
And according to reports, Dallas Humber was initially radicalized as a kid, right? As a teenager, through anime art. Have you ever heard of people coming into this white supremacist world through anime?
Yeah, a lot of this terrorist scene in particular partly developed off of the DeviantArt platform. It's very aesthetic heavy. You know, a lot of it's kind of intellectually flimsy, and so people are driven by the sort of the mythos of it. Sometimes people talk about fascism as an aestheticization of politics, right? It's not really a deep analytical way of seeing the world. It's more of an emotive push. And it's not uncommon for people to be involved in radical politics as teenagers, left or right. I don't think that's terribly unusual at all on that part. So yeah, I mean, she's part of a whole generation of people who probably get into politics from that perspective, through that route.
What are the other gateways for young people to enter this community?
Well, I mean, what isn't done on social media these days, you know? So online gaming has long been a avenue, an on-ramp into white supremacist milieu. Different kinds of social media. I mean, like, on your last guest was talking about problems in Facebook groups, but white supremacists will, I mean, I could see a white supremacist going into a Facebook group designed for, you know, emergencies and attempting to push their doctrines or their ideas there. They'll take any possible hook they can have it. They go into especially marginalized religions. They'll go into Satanism. We've seen a huge spread of Nazi Satanists, again, amongst this terrorist wing of the neo-Nazi milieu, in like racist versions of Christianity, or they'll try to enter more regular versions of like Eastern Orthodoxy and then try to recruit people to white supremacy there, sometimes in music and black metal. Like I said, you know, different online platforms, they'll find anything that they can get their claws into, and then they'll go attempt to push their ideas there. TikTok, there's a lot of stuff on TikTok. We even see very strange fringe things that we thought went away, like Christian identity. This racist version of Christianity that was really only being practiced by like very much, much older people in their 70s and 80s suddenly is popping up. The doctrines are popping up on TikTok. So they'll use their claws to get into anything they can.
I imagine that young people can get into some of the stuff you're talking about, but then maybe grow out of it. What kind of people tend to be vulnerable to this kind of full-on radicalization?
Well, we found, obviously, for white supremacists, mostly white people, although not entirely. It's a strange phenomenon. You know, disenchanted people, but we found a lot of this stuff is very cross-class, first off. It doesn't really seem to glob around a particular region. I mean, at certain times, some more than others. It's pretty broad across society amongst white people. Obviously, disenchanted people, disaffected people will be drawn towards this stuff. people have different backgrounds, but it's really weird. Sometimes they come from racist families, and sometimes they come from, left-wing families. Like, we've heard all kinds of different stories. It's kind of interesting with white supremacists. People can come to that movement, that political philosophy, from all different kinds of directions, like from the left or from the right, from art, from through being artists, or from being in another political milieu or exploring political ideas and then stumbling upon this stuff.
Yeah, in this case, she was an artist. She was doing some of her own anime, and it looked like, as a kid, she had, some artistic talent, and then it kind of became more abhorrent from there.
Well, I mean, Hitler was a, people say failed artist. I don't know what that means. He was an artist, and he had a very nice aesthetic sensibility. Fascism has always been had a strong aesthetic sense. You can definitely, if you ever look at, I'm sure your listeners ever do this, but if you look at like fascist and white supremacists, especially like neo-Nazi art, and compared to like Trumpist aesthetics, they're quite different. I personally feel like the fascists have a much better aesthetic sense, and they really concentrate on that. This milieu that Terry Graham is around is very aesthetic heavy, and so they spend a long time crafting that. That is not in contradiction with their politics in any way.
And tell me about how people get sucked in. I mean, from the initial kind of maybe flirtation with these kind of groups, once they enter this community, what causes them to really go for it and move, further and further in the ways that Dallas Humber is alleged to do?
Well, I mean, people enter into any kind of social or political kind of current. They have their own reasons for doing it. It makes sense to them rationally. It provides a sense of community. It gives them an outlet for activities. And then I think with a lot of the things you enter into now, generally people would get, for example, into subscribe to a Telegram channel and participate in chats. And at some point, if they're the right person, get invited into more private settings where they're talked to directly. And so once people do enter the white supremacist movement, they have an option about whether they want to be in the more moderate or more radical side of it. And then sometimes this movement itself also goes up and down. Are the radicals, are the most radicals, are the most violent people in ascendance? Is that like almost like a fad at that time, or isn't it? And people can rise and fall with that. If you're younger, you just enter things. Often people want to be on the cutting edge of something, right? They don't have the background, the baggage from having been around. And like, if we're in a moment, and we kind of are in this moment, where like the cool cutting edge thing is to be promoting massacres, and it's very easy, I think, for someone who's just become interested in these ideas, who's just drunk the Kool-Aid, to be right there with it, right? Like, there's not a break on them to maybe necessarily think twice. There might be for a more experienced person.
And this is what Dallas Humber was accused of doing, is promoting murder, egging people on. She allegedly explained that the canonization of mass murderers made aspiring attackers more willing to commit violence and then attain what she called sainthood. Is this a proven mm-hmm. way to get people to commit murder? Do we see this time and again?
Well, she was very good at what she was doing, clearly, but the sainthood, now mass murderers, white supremacist mass murderers, get dubbed saints. They make these, often quite nice looking. I mean, I think there are a lot of good artists in this milieu, which helps attract people, these beautiful icons of these racist mass murderers. But we have to acknowledge that martyrology crosses all kinds of political perspectives. I mean, the left has often done this, Islamists do this. Secular leftists in the Middle East do this, where people, hold up pictures, talk about the members of their political movement who've been killed, who've died for their beliefs. And so the white supremacists are doing that too. We shouldn't think that that's unusual. It's not a usual thing in the United States, but in the rest of the world, it's, I think, not untypical.
I was going to say, you mentioned the left, and I want to touch on the other extreme side of the political spectrum. To what extent do we see violent activity, or the plotting of violent activity, even murder, on the left? Is that a thing?
Oh, in the United States, almost none. Nobody is encouraging people to murder anybody in the United States on the left. I mean, the last time there was stuff like this was the 1970s. These groups had, like the Weather Underground, had come out of the New Left movement. But some people would like to, sometimes for political reasons, to equate the two, and there's just simply no equation. The left isn't committing mass murders. Even the most radical people, they're not committing mass murders. They're not encouraging their followers to commit mass murders. Like, this stuff is almost entirely a phenomena of the far right and of Islamists.
So when we're talking about individual risks, how difficult is it to discern what groups or individuals are actually dangerous versus those people who just might be, using their imaginations, getting carried away in online forums, but don't actually pose any actual risk?
Because we're no longer in an age in which there were organizations, structured organizations promoting their members to take these actions, I now, and I think others, there's becoming more of a consensus that intent does not matter. And so if we're talking about, is the person promoting these acts, are they serious or not? It no longer is relevant if it ever was. The people who are listening to them, the intent of the speaker, of the propagandist, does not matter to the listener they're encouraging. Do you know what I mean? So if the propagandist or the person creating propaganda is doing it because they think it's ironic or funny, it has the same effect. If you have a platform with 100,000 subscribers or followers or whatever, and you're encouraging people to go commit massacres, like, whether you think it's a joke or not, isn't going to affect whether the listener feels that way. We found there was one, mostly online group called the Feuer Creek Division, and had been founded by a 12-year-old. And people
Wow.
had been who adults who were part of this group had gone and committed violent crimes. It does not matter who the propagandist is, what their actual identity. We find people who are Jewish and gay and people of color who are hiding behind these online identities, but their effect is just the same.
So, Spencer, just in our last minute, I want to talk about the relationship or lack thereof between the instigators of this, extreme white supremacist murder and just organized far-right groups we see domestically, like the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers. What's been the impact? Like, first off, is there some relationship between these groups? And then secondly, is what's the status of these groups like Proud Boys and Oath Keepers?
What's their relationship to the more extreme wing, or?
Yeah, what's the is there a relationship between that extreme? I mean, we're talking about the kind of from organized right-wing groups into fringe. Is there a connection? Can people go from one to the other?
Absolutely. So you need to look at them. They're all part of an ecosystem, with the most radical groups being on one side of it, but it all blends into each other. So, for example, I said on 1/6 that most of the groups we're talking about are people more moderate than what happened on 1/6, but there were a few of the white supremacists there. In the Proud Boys, they have a neo-Nazi-like wing of it. Like, there's a constant problem with attrition of people leaving the Proud Boys and moving to the right into neo-Nazi groups. And then there's this larger idea of accelerationism, and we've been talking about white supremacist accelerationists, but others who are not explicit white supremacists on the right embrace accelerationism. And the accelerationists all start to, if not directly cross-pollinate, influence each other. So when you have these very hardline neo-Nazi accelerationists, they're creating a kind of gravity that affects accelerationists, even who are more, like, quote unquote, politically moderate, among groups like the Proud Boys or other groups. So it all acts together in this whole, like, ecosystem. They're all aware of each other. They're all interacting with each other. They're all competing with each other for recruits or such on some level.
Well, Spencer, this is a unsettling topic, but I really appreciate you illuminating this for our listeners.
Sure, I'm always here to ruin everybody's day.
Spencer Sunshine is an author and researcher of the far right. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Alan Young. We're back in just a moment.